Okay, it is the 23rd of April. I know I've got the recordings of the class in various devices. I've got to put them all together. I really hope to get that done by the end of the weekend, now that things are working towards a successful conclusion, let's put it that way. So I think, if I recall correctly, since we are getting towards that time of year again, I believe what we've discussed is that the final exam will be a take-home 24-hour exam, correct? Okay, I don't want to be changing things midstream without intending to. That I will be posting no later than the very first moment of exams a series of questions which will essentially be much like the exercises we've done. These are not question and answer kinds of questions. These are going to be exercises, practical exercises, whether it's marking things up, reviewing them, understanding them, translating them for a client, trying to synthesize and show your ability to synthesize both our theoretical discussion and the practical exercises that we've done throughout the semester. You will have until the very last minute of the last scheduled exam to submit your answers. So you, if you want the full 24 hours, and you won't need, or you shouldn't need to take 24 hours worth of working to do it, but you should be sure not to check out the exam later than 24 hours before the end of the last exam, because I will be putting this via TWEN, so if you've had any problems with the TWEN page in the past, now's the time to fix them. Have you all had experience downloading an exam from TWEN and then putting your exam number in and then uploading it? Good. If anybody has any problems, things can happen. If you are someone who likes to, yes? It's always a good idea. I do get notice from the registrar as to which test numbers are associated with graduating students. However, if you'd like to also notify me, that might be of value, and so on. So that's really what we're talking about. I think it won't be necessarily hipster, but it will be a fact pattern, and either draft something or come up with something or analyze something or mark something up and provide changes. And as we get closer, we'll talk about the kind of resources you're allowed to use. This is not a closed book exam, clearly, so take that as you will. Anyone have any good licensing experiences over the break? I had a very interesting discussion with my 16-year-old son. I'm sorry?
I said sadly enough when I answered that question
was
yes.
Oh, an interesting one? Professional or personal?
Professional.
Ah. Well, we would.
How much we could really discuss.
Exactly. That's always the challenge. So here, I do want to get into these, but I just want to spend 5 minutes because it's the kind of question that a client could have raised. Are any of you familiar with, some of you will, some of you won't. I'm not even going to go with that. So there is a tool out there that allows people to modify Pokemon games, the Pokemon games for Nintendo, various systems from the Game Boy on to the 3DS. Generally, it's the earlier, simpler games. And essentially, these tools will allow a user not to rewrite the programming, but perhaps to change certain elements. It knows, the tool knows where these elements are stored, whether it's a character or a character name or gameplay elements. And you basically can choose to make your own version of this and then play it. But you can't play it on in the most circumstances on a handheld, because instead you play it on an emulator. You download a program to your tablet or to your computer, your phone, and it simulates in software the hardware of a Nintendo Game Boy or a Game Boy Advance or whatever. You load up your modified ROM, that's what they're called, ROMs, read-only memory, it's your modified version of the game, and you play it. Raises some interesting IP issues. Do you own the game? Have you purchased the game? Generally speaking, there's no consumer easy way of pulling a ROM out of a little cartridge for modification. People have custom hardware to do this, etc. So my son, who's very interested, asked me about the legalities. Legalities of doing this. And I tend towards its personal use. It's a game we've already purchased. You know, you want to modify it to play it differently on your home computer? It may not necessarily be authorized by Nintendo, but it's probably not something that's going to really cross that line. But then he asked if he could post it or email it to his friends for them to play. But then we get into the licensing question. And that brings in another popular thing in video game culture called the Let's Play. And a couple of you are nodding and the rest of you are looking at me like you should be, because you're too busy doing law school things to actually know what a Let's Play is. A Let's Play is exactly what it sort of sounds like. It is a video of other people playing a video game while talking about how they're playing a video game. It's a genre. Don't ask me. It is. Some of them are very, very popular. And my son has a few. If you want to look for Diglett's other half, you'll see a few of his. But he asked me, was he permitted to do a Let's Play of his modified game? Which brings in the issues of the Let's Plays generally, and the different game publishers have sort of taken a different tack. I mean, we talked about copyright, and we understand that public performance is one of those rights that is reserved. So, since Pokemon is, in fact, a Nintendo franchise, not they own it, not just the hardware, but the software, they have every right to prohibit public performances of anything. You know, they would. And while you wouldn't necessarily think there'd be a market for a public performance of a video game, there is. There is. I think one of the things that Nintendo has chosen to do is not tell YouTube to take them down, which would be within its rights, but simply tell YouTube that if anybody puts them up, the only company, the only person that's going to be permitted to have advertising revenue from these Let's Plays is Nintendo. You go do it, but you're not allowed to make money on it. But then you get these modifications. And who owns those? It just got, and I have to say, as and my kids are, I don't want to say even properly, my kids are more sophisticated than most, by virtue of osmosis, and they've sat in on my classes, about these issues. But I will say, my son was very frustrated as to why he could not demonstrate his creativity in modifying this game. And so it was sort of an object lesson of dealing with clients. Now, granted, clients are usually, first of all, hopefully paying you. Second of all, not likely to ask you as their lawyer if they're permitted to post it for their friends to play. But it's sort of the same concept, that clients come with preconceptions, misconceptions about what is or isn't permissible and what should be and what they want to do. And often you have to come up with an answer that's as close to yes as you possibly can, because otherwise the client's just going to stop asking. Sometimes there is no yes. Anyway, that was the sort of interesting licensing moment, but that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about our negotiation. We've pretty much all had a chance to do this, either with Paul Rebell or with me. One piece of feedback I can say, having watched the ones I did, is I talked too much, and I apologize. I tend to do that. But I think you all got a good chance. As I believe you all heard, the feedback that Paul gave and the feedback that I gave were both largely positive. I think you all did a solid job with this. General comments, again, shared Paul as well as in my observation. Paul, for those that were in his group, he shared that his advice was to prioritize, especially if you're not sure how long you had and all of you had just had half an hour, to be prepared to start with the most important things for your clients, the things you have to get. And I think that was not necessarily how your groups collectively approached this, but it's good advice. I think both sets of negotiations discovered the challenge of understanding the business issues that the other side faces. There were a few circumstances, for example, where a number of groups quite reasonably suggested that in order to track unique revenue coming from their efforts on behalf of this joint relationship, that there should be unique codes generated. And so each user would have a unique code, a one-time use code, and then it would go away, and it wouldn't be shareable with other people. And what Paul raised, and then what I raised, is something that he and I have both seen in practice, which is that's not easy, and it's not cheap. And so I think it would be it's valuable to consider what may be a perfectly reasonable theoretical idea that you're proposing or your client is proposing. You have to really understand, is this workable? Or if we do it, can we do it? If we're asking the other side to do it, can they, will they, and what is it going to cost? The other general observation was that, and to a certain extent it was an artifact of how we did the simulation, these were not negotiations about legal terms, were they? Did you guys get much into the actual wording of any of the contract terms? A little. But what were they? What did you end up talking about? When you got to it, but what was most of the conversation about indemnification? What was it about? It was about how this was actually going to work. And I think that was valuable too. It's certainly the way Paul went with his groups, and I thought that was quite a useful way to approach it. Because that's what we do as lawyers. That's why being an in-house lawyer is, I think, a better place to be if you're negotiating a contract. Because if you negotiate in a vacuum, all you're talking about is the legal words. You don't have a good handle on the business deal for your own client, let alone the other side. It just doesn't go smoothly. You don't pick up the things that aren't there. Yeah. Fair enough, although I think it was their form agreement, right? And to a certain extent, yeah, that certainly was something that might have thrown you off. On the other hand, you needed to be able to, even if it wasn't the first conversation that your client was having with his client, part of the pitch issue, even if it's not the first time, is the leverage question. And I think that even if they had been discussing this for a long time, his point, and again, I took his lead because I thought it was a valuable way to approach it, was you're trying to get this client, right? That your companies needed us more than we needed you. Now, that may not be true. Might not have been true there. But if that is the case, it shifts the leverage of the negotiation drastically.
I think we went in with leverage on our side because the fact that I said they're a startup company with no experience. So
yes, it did. On the other hand, it also said that they were attached to a very big company with a lot of money.
Right.
And I think that's a value. And I think all of you were able to address that. So let's sort of go. First, you know, do we have reps from all four groups, sort of? The AGG folks. Tell everybody about AGG. Do we have AGG here? Wasn't it AGG? Or was it? Was that you? It was you. I thought it was AGG. What were you? VGG?
Yeah.
Sorry. It's a little hard to hear. So tell everybody about VGG. Now, that was not your original company, right? And I think it was a really good choice. I think there were better choices all around, those of you who changed. But so, yeah, the idea is they're a creative company and the video game company is a creative company. Two different media with some shared set of characters. So in your planning, VGG people, what did you think were the biggest risks? This is about risk management. What were the biggest risks that this business relationship might raise for your client?
Well, the warranties were all in their favor, and we had deleted the entire production.
Stop there. We're not talking about the language. What were the risks? Why were the warranties important? What could go wrong? So let's be a little more meta. So what was that risk? The risk is you put in money, create something, try to sell it, and then what? You don't own it. That's a really important risk. When you're doing creative work based on someone else's stuff, the risk is even if you're adding something new, you don't own it. And that completely changes the economics. Now, why then, if that's the risk, I don't know if you guys have thought this through, but why would any publishing company write books based on someone else's characters? Why not just write your own books based on your own characters? So it's a shortcut. It's a shortcut to, right, the people who write Star Trek novels. Most of them are pretty darn good authors. So why are they writing Star Trek novels? Because they don't have to do a whole lot of main character development. Why do they publish Star Trek novels? They don't have to do a lot of character development. Novelists who start from scratch have to tell you who their characters are. But if you're writing a Star Trek novel, you don't. Maybe a couple of your side characters, or you come up with some sort of new gloss on what Catherine Janeway had for lunch last week and her food allergy that never came up in an episode or whatever. But you don't have to establish that. It's a shortcut. So that's what made this a really interesting idea. We're going to create books based on your characters. But you're right. The benefit is they're hopefully doing the work of, you know, building the understanding and building your market. The bad news is they may own it. And what other risks beyond sort of your choice of your business? You're betting your product line, your efforts on the success of their characters, right?
As well as some of the bad reputation that reflects on us and all of the money we put into developing those characters goes down the tubes because no one wants them anymore.
Or if it's just a failure. Remember, this is a new game. You're taking a risk. So I think that's where you as a risk manager need to focus. Then you have to look at the provisions in the contract that address that. So if you're worried about ownership, the fact is they do own it, right? It's a derivative work. So what can you do in an agreement, let's look at the name of the class, to make sure that you're not stepping on any legal rights? What do you need in order to do this? You need a license. So the licensing terms, whether or not you know, that's right there, right away. That's got to be number one. You need a license to do this. Whether it's an exclusive license or not, the term of the license, before you do anything else, you got to start with the license. So if you're thinking priorities, that's got to be it. And then you've got the issues of, what are they doing to this shared joint property? And how is it reflecting on you and exclusivity and all that sort of thing? And then you think about how you're going to make money and how you're going to use that. So how was it that your company figured it would make money from the deal beyond selling books? What did you need them for?
Mm-hmm. And that whoever clicked on the video game through our site, we also generate some kind of money from that.
Yep. So let's see where that goes.
When they open the code, there's going to be advertisements when they have to open it. So we're going to make money through those advertisements.
Okay, so there's a code, and then?
One of the ideas we've been going around is maybe giving them, or furnishing
So he did ask the technology question, and it's an important one. So you talked about the contract. Do you guys recall where the contract discussion went and whether you thought you were getting to the right? Well, he could say that all he wants, right? Remember, a lot of this can be, I don't want to say theater. It's a great word, but I don't want to say theater. But some of this is style. And nobody is going to say to you, well, you have more leverage than we do. Everyone is going, his view is his client's most important. And so you need to be prepared. Again, he could take that attitude all he wants. But for you, your client is most important. So yes, he was definitely pushing hard. And I don't think, but he was polite about it.
No, he wasn't. I mean, he cursed out or anything, but he was definitely...
So let's see if we can see him talk golden egg stuff. Well, he's not going to tell you otherwise, is he? Of course, he'll say his game's going to be popular. Now, what you don't know, and I'm not going to share with you yet, is the fact pattern I gave him, the behind-the-scenes fact pattern. Because there were questions that really nobody asked. Nobody asked about this software that hadn't yet hit the marketplace. And everyone was assuming that wasn't an issue. It never came up. Has anyone ever seen a piece of complicated software hit the marketplace on time with no problems? Well, maybe you have, but it's not a commonplace occurrence. Things happen.
We addressed that when we said we wanted to test it and have the right to terminate it if they didn't meet standards.
Yes, and what was the response? Well, I mean, to a certain extent, yeah, so I'm not saying, I don't want to say nobody addressed it, but there's a certain amount of, you know, he's telling you it's going to be successful.
Characters that we create, of those characters in our works as well. And we know your product is one of the best products, so we want to be a part of that, and we made it successful.
So if you're concerned about him, you know, why did you tell him we know your product's going to be one of the best products? Yeah.
So, again, going into it assuming that...
But then he's going to have to go back to his client and say, I didn't get your deal for you.
No, I understand that. And that's why, I mean, in hindsight, there's definitely things that would have changed. But I think that it was a little confusing because we thought that now we were pitching to them.
Fair enough. And I think you were.
Right. So then it became, I just want to get this deal.
But you could also keep in mind that even in the context, and this is not meant as a negative criticism, more to sort of an observation, that even if his approach is a pitch, you could simply say, here's the explanation. Right? You just don't understand how valuable we are. Right. Good. I don't know if we can get to the word golden egg. All right, I just want to, here's another issue. I don't think any of you provided a markup to opposing counsel, which meant At some point, you were giving opposing counsel views of your drafts with your notes. This is never a good idea. Okay. He did. And if he had taken your purse, would you have had the same response? I know. You all, and again, this was, so what was it, VGG? I want to get that right. You're all trying to be helpful and be productive, and I really appreciated that. Okay. Gamebox. Our Gamebox team, tell us about Gamebox. Look how professional they look. Tell us about Gamebox. What was Gamebox? He wasn't buying it, but it wasn't a bad idea. And I think ultimately you rose to it, and here's why we're different, et cetera. So that wasn't such a bad thing. So what did you think the biggest risks to your client were? Right, so that's when part of the challenge is making sure you explain things correctly. Like when you say, you start with, we want your source code. Now that's not what you meant. You started out with, we want your source code. That's not what you meant, but that's what you said, and that's gonna be a problem. If you're talking about testing, right, very important to say what kind of testing. Are you talking about consumer interest testing? Are you talking about bug testing? And why you want it, and then you make the case. But software developers as a whole, and I think you saw that from both opposing counsels, they are not going to want to require themselves to fix anything. Doesn't mean you can't make them in the contract, but it's not something they're going to want to do. So that might have been a bit of a challenge. Now, there was a moment, I really wanted to annotate this, and I couldn't get the annotation thing going.
The parent company told me.
I think,
hold on.
That was a good moment. And I think it was a point that wasn't necessarily brought out as well as it should have. Think about the fact pattern. We have Fogey and Hipster, right? Hipster's the startup. Fogey is the humongous, large, well-capitalized investment firm. From your perspective, whose money do you want to be on the line? Whose signature do you want at the bottom of that contract? You want Fogey. And I think your group was sort of trying to get to that. From his perspective, and mine also, there's a reason they spun off Hipster as a separate corporate organization, an LLC, so that its liabilities were protected from Fogey's. And so that could actually have been, I mean, we didn't really have time to draw it out, but that fact pattern was there, that piece was for a reason, because you want to think about resources. It's not just the copyright issues, which is, I think, where you were focusing, but it's that ownership issue, and I think it's an important one.
And vice versa. So, I don't know if Google, for example, would want to work with us.
All right, hold on. All right, so this was an interesting one. Do you guys remember this? All right, so this was actually the change of control, right? This was the, you went to the, I think this was the assignment provision. So he went to it, rather.
Hopkins is Joe Schreiner. What's the
9.6, which is?
This is my exit now. Tell me, if I finally have Google Knox, I can sell my company. Can you direct terminate?
Yeah, that is changing control.
Right, okay. So I suspect that you did not think this was going to be the one that you were going to get to. Right? This was changing control. We have the right to terminate. But I think you raised a good point. That his view is we're building a company to sell it to somebody. That's a change in control. And if this is my business and I have a contract that won't continue necessarily if there's a change in control, that's a problem. I think it's an instructive moment because it was not one, well, you gave him a markup and it wasn't one that you were thinking was going to even, it wasn't on your radar. You don't always know what's going to be sensitive to the other side.
But, I mean, we just wanted to make sure we were working with people that had the same incentive.
It's not a bad...
The next person down the line is not going to contemplate the same thing with us. We're not guaranteed that.
It's not at all a bad idea, right? That we're working with you, and if somebody else comes in, maybe it's our competitors, whatever, right? We want the right to terminate. It's not a bad idea in practice, in theory, but in certain contexts, you could see where it would, and you need to have a fallback. You need to think, okay, what are my concerns? My concern is that the business deal will change. I'm dealing with a competitor, whatever. So maybe you propose, you know, someone who's, or we have the right, which will not be unreasonable, you know, we have the right to consent to continue or whatever, not to be unreasonably withheld, or something else. Because, yeah, you have concerns, but so do they. So you have to think, did you have your, not say you would have, but you need to have your sort of second approach if they object. Was there a...
No, you got an answer with, I was just kind of thinking more in terms of that, whether it came to us or that, and you kind of spoke about it.
Right.
Having the opportunity to work with Google with the potential good things, what the options they have as well.
Right. And that's not all, you know, that's not even a termination. Sometimes it's an assignment. So rather than saying the agreement will terminate, sometimes it simply says that you're not allowed to hand over, if it's a corporate acquisition and Hipster remains as Hipster LLC, there really isn't a change. It's still Hipster. But if there's a sale of assets or something else, right, sometimes agreements are just assigned. You're taking this over for us. You didn't negotiate with them. That might actually be consent to an assignment, not to be unreasonably withheld. Those sorts of things. Because then it becomes a negotiation. What do you need to permit this assignment? It's not always smooth, but that's one of those areas. Were there any other moments you can think of that resonated with you?
Warranty. He was not happy about the warranty. We weren't even asking
that. That's section 311.
This is where we were? Well, this was the indemnification discussion. You want to share people the $10 million? This was a... Fair enough. So this was the cap on his on Hipster's liability, right? Hipster's liability shall be no more than $10 million, which is a wonderful number. It's a little scary.
I mean, it was based on the numbers we were given.
That's fine.
But it was never intended to get...
Yeah, it got to a point where it became bad faith, and we didn't even intend to go in that direction.
Right. So, look. You will have moments where opposing counsel is very aware of that. but latches onto it to put you off your guard.
Yeah. What I said to him, like, can we just forgo the $10 million? Like, because this is not even part of our company. Like,
except you put it there,
yeah,
right?
But not for.
You have to. I understand that. But if you're going to put a change in, you're going to have to be prepared to defend it, even if ultimately you're prepared to give it up, right? To say, well, we project profits of $10 million, that has nothing to do with exposure. $10 million profits, great, but that's not a risk calculus. That's how much money they might make on this. You have to say, okay, it's not what their profits are. To tie, and I think this is where you got a little bit sort of at sea, but here's why. The whole idea of that indemnification, because that's where this was, is, hey, hipster, we get sued for something you did. We're not going to be out of pocket, right? Or if we have to sue you for something you did, we will ultimately be made whole. That's what indemnification, and that's the cap on limits on liability, right? But that, whose money, whose exposure is that about? Is it about hipsters, or is it about game boxes?
In protecting, you mean in getting...
Right, so to say, hey, hipster, we won't take you for more than everything you'll possibly make is not, that's not a defensible position. If you say to them, look, we're investing $10 million in doing this, so we're already looking at a potential exposure, or these kinds of lawsuits tend to be $10 million judgments, so that's the number we're talking about because that's the likely exposure. That's when you can stand up for it. But think about what you were saying. Again, I understand it. But even setting aside our, perhaps his over-focus on it, but what your proposal, the reason for your proposal was saying was, we think you're going to make $10 billion, right? So therefore, that's what we're going to cap your life, all of your profits. There's a flip side of that, which is he could say, and often you do see this from a company, if we're going to be liable, the most we're willing to take on is what you're paying us, right? So if nothing else, we'll give it all back, we'll be done, right? And you see that often, that the maximum liability is the amount paid or payable under this agreement. That has some logical connection. Tying it to their proposed profits, setting aside his focus on it, that's ultimately not a good foundation for that number. And I think that's where he was able to put you off your guard.
Yeah. I mean, the nature of our business was to put him in connection with, to make more money. So,
granted.
If he damages our connection to that company, that's, I think, what we were looking for.
So, but if you tie it even to the value of the contracts or the flow through that, you know, you're putting it and the money he's making through your deals, that's one thing. To say $10 million because the market thinks you're going to profit $10 million on this scheme.
He never said $10 million. I stand by that.
What does it say in the draft you gave him?
He took our copy and read it.
Okay.
So we
because you didn't have... Okay, but so then you shouldn't have given it to him. That's why you need to have a markup that you're allowed to, right? You never want to give him your notes.
Yeah. And I would have never given them. None of us would have in real life.
According to the definitions and references.
which was a little bit, I think he was sort of intentionally obtuse, and it's tough. I think he did a good job of simulating a lawyer who doesn't always go forward. Okay, good. Yes,
I'm. As far as the signatures with Hipster and Bogey, wouldn't you want both of those signs?
You would.
Okay.
You absolutely would.
Okay.
Yeah. He and I absolutely would not. This is a separate legal entity. It's got a separate board of directors. This is the entity that is doing this game. The fact that we may have corporate organizations is irrelevant to this discussion. And that is something I suspect that Hipster's counsel would have absolute firm marching orders about. So, you know, you'd have to decide whether Hipster's capitalization, the money in Hipster, was going to be sufficient. And there are things that go into that. Even if all you have is Hipster's signature, assuming that Fogey is in fact a legitimate, well-respected, you know, you're not talking about Hipster, a wholly owned subsidiary of Bernie Madoff Incorporated. But, you know, so Hipster has, so Fogey has a certain reputational incentive not to let this software company explode spectacularly. And it may be okay for your client to rely on that. But that's something your client, with your help, is going to have to evaluate. Here's the risk.
Okay.
We have our beverage providers. Oh, beverage providers. Tell us a bit, was it Soda & Co? Is that?
I remember, she made it up.
Soda something.
Yeah.
So, it was, again, that was not where you started with the markup. Tell everybody about Soda & Co, or whatever it was called. What was the idea?
We were a soda company, and we were going to come out with some limited sodas. So basically, we were going to put the code.
Apparently, that's a bottle of the. Right, but it wasn't simply an advertising deal, right? These were sodas that were tied to the game in some way. So, very creative. How does a beverage company leverage, you'll pardon the pun, or the rhyme anyway, how does a beverage company tie its fortunes to a video game? Answer, you come up with custom flavors inspired by the game, brand co-branded with the game, and promoting the game under the cap. Which very likely, you absolutely, you see this all the time in real life. So you take, for example, what are they called? The Jelly Bean Company. Jelly Belly, yeah, whatever. Jelly Bellies, right? So J.K. Rowling comes up with Bertie Bott's every flavored beans in the Harry Potter books, right? Alas, earwax, says Dumbledore when he gets one. That was the Jim Dale, my imitation of Jim Dale. Never mind. Anyway, do you know that the Jelly Belly Company came out with Bertie Bott's every flavored beans? And they were, in fact, every flavor? I'm not sure about earwax, but we saw them at Harry Potter the Experience, and you can buy them, and absolutely. Logical, right? So they came out with custom flavors, very much like what you were talking about. Custom flavors, co-branded. Makes a lot of sense. So what were the risks that you saw your soda company having with this relationship? With choosing to do, this was your deal, choosing to do a soda deal with a video game. What were the risks? What was your client most concerned about?
Whether or not the video game would have any glitches or would affect us negatively in any way.
Because there, you're not directly distributing the game. You're not using its characters. It's very much, you're assuming it's going to be a success and that there's going to be some promotional value in tying your product, your existing products, because you're not a startup, to this. You know, so that's an important risk. And whether they do something that, you know, but also I think that they, you know, if they decide that a big portion of the game is going to be poisons in soda bottles, that could be a problem. You don't want the game to have, right, how to win the game, go to the soda machine in the game, buy the poison soda, and give it to your enemies. Not a good thing to have associated. So you needed some sense of where the game was going and everything else. What was the concerns that the very accomplished opposing counsel had? Well, before I say that, those of you who weren't here watching, I guess, was there no one else in the room? I don't remember if... what do you think the video game company might be concerned about with this deal? What would be the risks from the video game company? That, I think, is probably because it is such an attenuated, you know, you don't want it to be icky soda. You don't want to be the brand that associates itself with New Coke or whatever. And ultimately, I think that's where this negotiation, because you've got two untested products. And as much as the soda company was going to be concerned, it had to be anticipate the fact that the video game company was going to be concerned about the quality of the soda and putting its brand with this soda. So that, I think, was a lot of where this discussion went. Was there anything, because that was somebody else doing this, was there anything in that negotiation that was particularly unexpected, not what you wanted, troublesome? Or thought it should, or maybe just
had. When you go in with that mindset, it catches you off guard.
And which is one of the reasons I think why we both did that, because you got to be prepared for someone who's got way too big of an opinion of his client's importance. Yes.
Asked us questions about how we were going to get the code generated.
I was just like, we had no idea.
which is a real issue. Which is a real issue. Not to say that, that other lawyer knew much about the soda business beyond sort of the I have no idea. But if you're going to ask for something, you need to understand, you may not need to know how unique codes are generated and how that programming happens, but to understand that there has to be some computer programming involved, and somebody's going to have to do that. Somebody.
We directed it to like our IT department.
Right, but. But it's more than that. If he had said, well, you know, we've got a really good company chef, or we have a chemist's division, right? And so we're going to get our people mixing your flavor for you. And, you know, and making sure that the sweetener is a good sweetener. Is that going to work for a soda company?
It's... No, you didn't want to put the expense into doing and generating the codes. So
So if you said that you didn't want to put the expense of changing the flavor, and I'd say, that's okay, we have a good company chef. He'll mix it up for you.
Well, we were allowing the other company to taste.
I didn't say taste testing. Would you have the other company changing your formula? That's what, this is why I sort of harped on it. And yes, you didn't understand, but if you're going to say to the other company, here's something that we're going to make you change, and it's code, it's part of your system, you can't just say, oh, we'll send our people in, because your people aren't their people, they don't know their business, their company doesn't have time to train your people. And you weren't the only ones, right? We had this issue, and Paul raised it as well, the issue of generating codes is just random, sequential numbers. Making the codes work. Building a system that says, okay, we haven't seen this code before. In the process of connecting to the actual game, has to happen in the actual game. And so whatever you ask, you have to at least have a sense, is this doable and what is it going to require? You don't have to know all the details. You wouldn't be expected to. But it really would, as if you would say, well, if the flavor doesn't work well, you know, we've tested it, but we don't have time to go ahead and remix flavors. It's a very complicated process. And I said, well, that's okay, because we've got some really great company chefs. Granted, it is, and I will say it is, it's one of the things that makes this a simulation, and it may well have been, and I said this before, my decision to let you guys pick your business made that more of a reality. If I had said, okay, here's your fact pattern, and each of you has the same company, and here's your company, and here's their company, what you're talking about wouldn't have happened. But I think it's less, this was an educational choice by me, and if it didn't work well for you guys, I apologize. I think you all stepped up to it. But in addition, it is true that sometimes you as the lawyer think the deal is done, and you're just marking up the contract, and you read through it, and you realize that there are a lot of open business questions. That someone has said, okay, we're going to do X. And no one has answered how we're going to do X. How we're going to afford X. Who's going to do X. And you as the lawyer, particularly if someone says, okay, we would like this change. So you have to say, okay. Because most of the time, your clients have not negotiated every single step of the way. They have, we're going to do a deal. You, lawyers, go write it up. You were going to do a deal. Go write it up. And so, okay, we're going to do unique codes. And we get credit for every code that comes in. Put that into the contract. Put that into the contract, unique codes. But your client never asked who's going to do it, because your client has even less of an idea than you do. And so you come in and you say, we're going to use unique codes. And the lawyer on the other side says, but we're not set up to do that. I know your sales guy and our salesperson agreed to this, but understand, they didn't check with the IT, with our developers. We don't have that capability now. That is a very real world situation. It's impossible in a half an hour to get past it. But that's real. Whether or not you're explaining the structure of the deal, sometimes you do have to tell the lawyer, because especially if it's outside counsel, the outside counsel may have no idea really what's going on. My client gave me this contract. I basically understand the deal, but tell me what's going on. You'll have those conversations. So, okay. So I think that the other place, there was discussion of change. Yeah, this is where we got into this. Good question. Absolutely. And you could, right? You came to us. Well, yeah, but still, right? We want to make sure, go right back to him. Just because he's very full of himself. And I think you did come back. I think you did come back with, yeah, but we're a huge soda company. Like I said, I was talking too much. Fair enough. And last but not least, the very, very creatively named ACWS. ACWS. Can't imagine where the name ACWS came from. Let's find out. They named their company after the lawyers. What a great thing. So ACWS people, tell us what your deal was. What was your company? What were you proposing?
It started off as a distribution company where our intention was that you would provide us with a single copy of your game and we would carry it on the cities and distribute it to whoever. And I guess the first 20 minutes of our conversation hashed that out. As far as to what extent
because the lawyer hadn't been told anything. He was clearly just not at all clued in about the fact that the deal had been done. Fair enough. What were your client's biggest concerns going in, besides the fact that the lawyer was going to talk your ear off for 20 minutes? So other than the fact that you were not sure, the lawyer wasn't really sure what the deal was, were there surprises, challenges?
The biggest thing for us is that we had a pretty detailed term sheet as far as what defined terms were based on our understanding entering into the negotiation, and that's where we would start, right? Make sure all the defined terms are correct and we could move from there. But the way we basically had to take all of our defined terms and throw them away because the nature of the deal didn't change. So those defined terms no longer fit within that structure.
And it does happen on occasion. So let's see.
Relationships we might be able to do.
If it's just one.
If what you're told me is you do manufacturing.
Yeah.
So we'll give you one complete copy of
Like I said, he talks a lot. So yeah, this was I think worth just highlighting as we finish up, figuring out what the provisions are getting at. The provision about protecting the rights and the cost of protecting the rights, and I think that's what 5.3 was, right? Sometimes that's simply, we're filing for copyright, we need you to sign something. And then it's appropriate for the person filing for the copyright to cover the cost if they need somebody to sign something or bring somebody in. But I think where this took a little bit of an odd turn was because of the context, the protecting the rights. Once, because the video game company was giving the distributor the ability to duplicate and distribute, there were protection issues there beyond simply establishing the rights. It got a little bit complicated. So I think the discussion was valuable. And then just as we got into the substance, we ran out of time. Okay. I was very pleased by all the groups. I think some of you did a better job of having all three or four or two of you speak than others. Here's what I'm going to do. By tomorrow, I will be posting these, not publicly, but someplace where your group can download yours. I'd like them by the end of the day Sunday so I can read them and think about them on Monday and we can discuss them Monday night. What you need to do as a group is draft a letter to your client and say, "Dear client, we had our negotiation, and here's what came up. Here's what we think we have achieved. Here's all the issues that..." Basically, take this negotiation and now translate it into client speak in an appropriate format as a letter to the client from the three of you. Now, you're all in-house, so dear colleague, essentially. But talk about what you went in there, and then you could say, don't say too many nasty things about the opposing counsel, but here are the questions that it turned out hadn't been answered, and here's what we need to do, here's what we did address, here's what still remains to be done. All right, so that, because that's the next step. After you've had the negotiation, you need to communicate, so I will let you review your videos and then collaborate. No, because collaboration is a little complicated. So, individual assignments. Each of you from your own group, so you don't have to summarize someone else's. Individual assignments, is that more, makes a lot more sense. So be interesting to see how each of you summarizes. So don't collaborate. Write your own, but by tomorrow I will be posting these four and emailing you where you can find it and download it. It's in an MP4 format, which should run on just about everything. Any questions? Thoughts? Yes.
So we're
we had a very brief, we had only a half an hour to negotiate with Hipster. Here's what we came in with. Here's what we discussed. Here's what we still have to do.